Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at PurdueGlobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Lex Talionis, or the Law of Retaliation, is perhaps better known by the more familiar maxim of taking an eye for an eye. Although codes of law had been established many years previously, the formal enacting of reciprocal justice is thought to have originated in Babylonian times with an ancient code proposed by Babylonian king Hammurabi. Carved onto a basalt pillar sometime around the middle of the 18th century BCE, Hammurabi's code consists of 282 laws outlining a variety of crimes, from simple theft to the refusal of accepting corn as a payment for a drink, alongside the various punishments criminals could expect to receive for perpetrating them. It is here, over 1,000 years before the creation of the Torah, later adapted as the Old Testament, that we first find such retributive ideas as, if a man has destroyed the eye of a man, they shall destroy his eye. Or, if a man should knock out the teeth of his equal, his teeth shall too be knocked out. The code listed 25 crimes that were considered capital offences, meaning those that were punishable by death. However, it isn't until the 16th century BCE that we see the first evidence of capital punishment actually being carried out, with the enforced suicide of an Egyptian nobleman accused of the heinous crime of practicing magic. Although invariably skewed in favour of the wealthier classes, it could be said that such penal laws were vital for the management of increasingly complex societies. For better or worse, in the years since those first punishments were meted out, capital punishment has been employed at some point by almost every nation and culture that has come into existence. Today, although the methods of execution might be considered more broadly humane, 57 countries continue to enforce a death penalty. For all those countries that have abolished it, there is one simple reason why that stands out above all others. A 2014 study released in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences concluded that over 4% of people sentenced to die in the United States of America have been convicted for crimes they did not commit. A figure that, if correct, would suggest that as many as 120 of the 3,000 prisoners currently on death row have been wrongfully convicted. And of the 1,467 prisoners that have been executed since 1976, as many as 60 of those people might well have been innocent of their supposed crimes. On hearing these statistics, there will be some in favour of the death penalty who might consider this little more than an unfortunate consequence of an essential system. Others, however, might think twice, given how often support for capital punishment stems largely from that old maxim of an eye for an eye. After all, as some might say, just because those innocent people are now dead, it doesn't mean they won't still be seeking retribution. This is Unexplained, and I'm Richard MacLean Smith. Early Saturday morning, October 31st, 1981, on the outskirts of the panhandle city of Amarillo, Texas, rain and sleet batter the chapel windows of the St. Francis Convent, where inside, 40 nuns are gathered for morning mass. As the ceremony comes to a close, Sister Bernice notices with alarm that Sister Tadea is not in attendance. A colleague sent to check on her whereabouts returns moments later, ashen-faced and gasping for air. "Come quickly," she says. Sister Bernice and the convent nurse race up the stairs to the narrow single-bed room at the far end of the hall, passing a small crowd gathered outside. Lying completely still on the floor is 76-year-old Sister Tadea Benz, naked under a sheet. The nurse rushes to the woman's side but is unable to find a pulse. The shake of her head is followed by gasps and muffled sobs from outside the room. It is only then that Bernice notices the drops of blood on Tadea's pillow and on the sheet draped over her body. Uncharacteristically, a dirty white t-shirt has been left on the floor. Turning back to the body, the nurse examines some bruising and scratches around the neck. "It was common during a heart attack to struggle for breath," she says, suspecting she may have clawed at her own neck and fallen out of bed in the panic. Deciding not to remove the sheet to protect their colleague's modesty, the devastated nuns wrap another around the body and lift it carefully onto the bed. After wiping some blood from Tadea's face, Bernice collects herself and makes the call to the convent physician. Dr. Winsett is fast asleep when the phone rings, but soon snaps into action. Satisfied with Sister Bernice's assessment, he instructs workers from the local funeral home to collect the body and deliver it to the mortician. As some of the nuns gather to pray for their dear departed colleague, others return to her room to straighten things out, knowing only too well how embarrassed Sister Tadea would have been for her room to be found in such a state. Having tidied a few things away, finally they strip the blood-streaked sheets from the bed and deliver them to the laundry room. An hour or so later, a soft knocking sound coming from the far end of the large community hall downstairs draws one of the sisters to an unlatched window beating gently against its frame. Hearing the crack of glass underfoot, she realizes one of the panes has recently been smashed inwards. Sister Bernice is informed immediately and in turn calls the police. When two officers arrive shortly after 9:30 a.m., they discover that the screen outside the window has been slashed, a long piece of wood that had likely been used to break the glass appears also to have been dumped on the ground below it. At the funeral home, having taken receipt of the body, the morticians are surprised to find a number of puncture wounds running up the side of Sister Tadea's body, from her thigh to her neck, which also has a significant amount of bruising. It's odd, they think, how the bruises look almost like finger marks. But since, due to a mix-up of information, Dr. Winsett had stated that the unfortunate nun had fallen down the stairs, they thought nothing more of it as they continue preparing the body for the embalming. Back at the convent, the sisters have gathered to determine if anything has been stolen at the suspected break-in, but find nothing of note to speak of. Perhaps the burglar had been spooked and run away, suggest the police, as they prepare to head back to the station. There was one thing, thought Sister Bernice. "What's that?" asks one of the officers. "We found our colleague, Sister Tadea, dead in her room this morning, but we think it was a heart attack," she says. The look on the officers' faces says it all. A short time later, an irate L.B. Bartlett, Potter County Justice of the Peace, furious that Dr. Winsett had not consulted him before sending Taddeo Benz's body to the funeral home, orders the embalming process stopped and the body to be held pending a formal inquest. By the time the police arrive, however, the cadaver has already been washed and the arterial embalming completed. Back outside the convent, homicide captain Jimmy Davis of the Amarillo Police Department arrives to oversee a search of the premises. Stepping out of his car into the cold, grey and wet, he takes a moment to assess the surroundings. Already, he has a bad feeling about this one. The convent, located on the quiet northeastern fringes of the city, is positioned 50 yards away from the end of Northeast 18th Avenue and surrounded by trees. Inside, Davis and his team mount a thorough search of the premises, beginning with Taddeo's room, where they find a bent butter knife under the bed and recover a number of fingerprints. Blood spatters are found on the inside of the building's back fire exit, leading Davis to suspect that if Taddeo had been murdered, the perpetrator most likely escaped that way. The dirty t-shirt and blood-stained sheets are collected from the laundry, and later a steak knife is found in the convent driveway. Facing the terrible prospect that their colleague may have been murdered, a few of the nuns recall strange incidences from the night before. One received a phone call sometime around 2:30 a.m. from a man calling himself Father Jose, who spoke with a Spanish accent and begged her to help with his sexual problems. Another recalled hearing a muffled scream coming from the direction of Taddeo's room sometime around 4:30 a.m. Later that afternoon, pathologist Dr. Ralph Erdman performs a formal autopsy, confirming everyone's worst fears. Taddeo Benz had sustained multiple blunt force trauma about the face, chest, and arms, and had been stabbed numerous times across her body. A crushed larynx is clear indication of death by strangulation. But there is something else. Sister Taddeo had also been raped, with her hymen being torn in the process. Erdman conducts a vaginal wash and successfully retrieves samples of sperm and prostate secretions before concluding that her death occurred around 4 a.m. that morning. He makes the call to Captain Davis to deliver the horrific news. For Davis, it is a particularly galling turn of events. Not only was there a rapist and killer on the loose, but if his hunch is correct, this isn't the first time he had struck. Are you always taking care of your family? Do you often take care of others and not yourself? Now it's time to take care of yourself, to make time for you. You deserve it. Teladoc gives you access to a licensed therapist to help you get back to feeling your best, to feeling like yourself again. With Teladoc, you can speak to a licensed therapist by phone or video. Therapy appointments are available 7 days a week from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. local time. If you feel overwhelmed sometimes, maybe you feel stressed or anxious, depressed or lonely, or you might be struggling with a personal or family issue, Teladoc can help. Teladoc is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy to change counselors if needed, for free. Teladoc therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast today to get started. That's teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast. Back in July, barely 2 miles from the convent, 77-year-old Nani Bryson had been due to meet some friends from her church group to go grocery shopping, but had failed to show up. When a friend from the group went to Nani's house to check up on her, she found 3 days' worth of newspapers accumulated on the front porch and the back door unlocked and ajar. Inside, she found Nani's dead body sprawled out on her bedroom floor, She had also been brutally raped and murdered, strangled to death with a telephone cord. The following week, three blocks away, a 12-year-old girl had woken in the middle of the night to find a man standing over her at the foot of her bed. Mercifully, the man fled when the child screamed for help. Later, footprints were found at the young girl's house that were the same found at the Bryson property. As it happens, there are potentially four more unsolved crimes of a similar nature, including the beating and rape of a 92-year-old woman that had occurred as far back as May. And there was more to come. The same afternoon Dr. Erdman is carrying out Sister Tadea's autopsy, Captain Davis receives word that another elderly Amarillo resident, aged 77, has been found in her home, beaten into a coma. The timing couldn't have been worse for the city's beleaguered police department, who were under heavy public scrutiny after failing to close a slew of capital murder investigations that had resulted in embarrassing acquittals and a number of costly retrials. Newly appointed police chief Jerry Neal and the recently elected district attorney Danny Hill are determined not to fail this time, with Hill being particularly eager to solve the case. With all the fire and brimstone of a Bible Belt minister, Hill had run for election on a promise of tougher reprimands for criminals and a promise to seek the death penalty more often and more swiftly. There would be no better opportunity to prove his worth. As children and their families gear up to celebrate Halloween that cold October night in 1981, things take a devastating and ominous turn when Captain Davis informs the press that Sister Tadea Benz of the St. Francis Convent has been found raped and murdered. Both Davis and Hill draw comparisons with the Bryson murder, with Hill not unreasonably stating he had strong feelings that the same person had been involved in both cases. The public are, of course, deeply shocked by the news, but that a virginal nun had been the victim triggers a particularly acute trauma. For the deeply religious, predominantly Christian population, it is a crime of unimaginable depravity, worthy of the devil himself. A task force is immediately set up to tackle the investigation, combining members of the Potter County Sheriff's Office, led by Lieutenant Jimmy Boydston, with the Amarillo Police Department being led by Lieutenant Gerald Jacobs. Both departments contributing their best and finest in pursuit of the rapist and murderer on the loose in their city. On Monday morning, Amarillo police officers begin a door-to-door sweep of the neighborhoods surrounding the convent, asking for any information that might be pertinent to the investigation. Less than half a kilometer away, the body of the gentle Sister Tadea Benz is being laid to rest. The much-loved nun, who had dedicated her life to helping others, had moved to the US from Switzerland in 1933. More than 200 people arrived to pay their respects at the service led by Bishop Leroy Matheson of the Amarillo Diocese. Later that evening, shortly before midnight, having spoken to most of the residents on Northeast 18th Avenue, two officers in a squad car heading back to the station notice a man standing in a front lawn, beating at a bush with a stick. At the sight of the car, the man rushes inside the house, a modest bungalow located three blocks down from the St. Francis Convent. The officers made a note of the address, number 4000, and ran a check on the property, finding it listed in the name of Charlotte Cameron. The officers add it to their report and clock off for the night. All in all, the leads reveal very little, other than a number of conflicting reports describing a Latino-looking man being spotted near the grounds of the convent the night before Sister Tadea's murder. But when the examination of the nun's sheets and nightgown reveals strands of jet black hair, similar to hairs found at the scene of Nani Bryson's murder, it is all the evidence District Attorney Hill needs. Within days, under DA Hill's instructions, the investigative team turned their attention to a number of Cuban refugees the majority of which were skilled and professional workers who had recently settled in the area. The refugees were received as part of a politically motivated placement program, assisting Cubans fleeing President Fidel Castro's anti-capitalist regime. Hill's efforts are scuppered, however, when Catholic Family Services, who had helped the refugees settle, refused to hand over background data for their clients. But then the police believe they have caught a break. 28-year-old Fernando Flores, a Cuban refugee who had recently arrived in the city from Miami, was picked up on the night of Tuesday, 3rd of November, in connection with a burglary and the attempted rape of a 21-year-old resident of North Amarillo that had taken place on Halloween night. Although Flores's prints failed to match with any found in Sister Tadea's bedroom, a raid of his apartment results in the discovery of a number of fibers on Flores's clothes that appear to be from Sister Benz's blue nightdress and bedsheets. A series of witnesses who claim to have seen a man lurking around the St. Francis Convent late on the Friday night identify Flores as the man they had seen. News of the refugees' arrest does much to calm the rising fear in the community, with many praising the fast and efficient efforts of the city's new district attorney. 2 days later, the force wait expectantly as identification technician Sergeant Greg Soltis flies to Washington, D.C., carrying two boxes of evidence to be tested by the FBI. Inside are a vast collection of samples of Flores and Sister Benz's clothes, the white shirt found at the scene, as well as the nun's bloody sheets, and the black hairs found in her room and on her body. By the afternoon, the Bureau returns their findings. Flores is not a match. In desperation, the police turn to the 77-year-old Amarillo resident who had seemingly been beaten into a coma the afternoon after Sister Tadea's murder. Having emerged from her coma, unable to remember anything about the attack, the woman is brought in to District Attorney Hill's office to meet with a hypnotherapist. After the session, in conjunction with a series of tests carried out on evidence from her home, the police are forced to concede that the woman was not attacked after all, but rather had fallen accidentally down her stairs. The investigation team are back to square one, and the pressure is beginning to mount. The community grows increasingly restless, fearful that the perpetrator is still at large, and frustrated once again by the possibility of yet another bungled investigation. The offer of a $10,000 reward for any information leading to the arrest and indictment of a suspect does little to move the case along. Over a week after the murder, on the early evening of Monday, November the 9th, at 4000 Northeast 18th Avenue, where police had witnessed a man apparently acting suspiciously outside, a family has gathered together to watch Monday night football. Mother of four, Charlotte Cameron, is casually knitting on her sofa alongside her two daughters and her 17-year-old son, Johnny Garrett, who is sitting at her feet when there is an unexpected knock at the door. Charlotte opens it to find a whole squad of police brandishing a warrant to search her property and for the arrest of her son. Before she has even had time to process the situation, Charlotte can only look on with shock and desperation as her son Johnny is handcuffed and marched into a waiting squad car before being taken away. Later that evening, the Amarillo Police Department hold a press conference to announce the arrest of 17-year-old Garrett in connection with Sister Tadea's rape and murder. As it turned out, Garrett's name had apparently come up after Detective Sergeant Walter Yager reviewed the initial leads that had been documented at the beginning of the case. Recognizing Garrett as the person who had been seen running into number 4000 Northeast 18th Avenue, Yager, who had also been processing fingerprints for a number of other burglaries at the time, ran Johnny's against the prints found in Sister Tadea's bedroom. Incredibly, they found a positive match with at least two prints. One found on the headboard of the nun's bed, and one on the butter knife discovered bent and discarded underneath it. As reporters start to disperse, Johnny's mother, Charlotte, is seen in floods of tears, shepherding her three other children into the Major Crimes Unit, desperately looking for more answers as to why her son had been arrested. What they tell her moments later, but hadn't yet told the press, stops her in her tracks. They know Johnny did it, they say, because he had confessed it only hours before. After arriving at the police station, Johnny had been led into an interview room where at 5 p.m. Detectives Morris and Jimmy Boydston would later claim to have elicited a confession from him. In the apparent statement, Johnny is alleged to have confessed to breaking into the convent loaded up on whiskey and acid, with the intention of stealing a number of stereos that he had been led to believe were inside. While looking around the convent, he was supposedly spotted by Sister Tadea, and in an effort to silence her, had ended up choking her to death, before deciding to sexually assault her corpse. The statement ended with Johnny apparently claiming to have left the convent the same way he came in, through the broken window, despite blood spatters being found by the convent's fire exit. There was only one problem. Johnny was refusing to sign the statement. Later that evening, when Charlotte is finally given a moment with her son, as he looks his mother in the eyes and tells her he didn't do it, it is clear to her that something terrible is happening. Part 2 of Lex Talionis will be released on Tuesday, May 1st. If you enjoy listening to Unexplained and would like to help support us, you can now go to unexplainedpodcast.com/support. All donations, no matter how large or small, are massively appreciated. All elements of Unexplained are produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Please subscribe and rate the show on iTunes, and feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can reach us online at unexplainedpodcast.com or on Twitter at unexplainedpod. Now it's time to take care of yourself, to make time for you. Teladoc gives you access to a licensed therapist to help you get back to feeling your best. Speak to a licensed therapist by phone or video anytime between 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. local time, 7 days a week. Teladoc therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast today to get started. That's TELADOC.com/unexplainedpodcast.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/concertweek to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.